It's getting to be that time of year when the warmest temps crowd together in the middle of the day, and if you don't go outside then, you might miss out. And it's almost cool enough to wish that a few more leaves would come down so there wouldn't be so much shade in the garden. But not quite. This is Into the Garden with Leslie on News Radio WINA. Our plant of the week this week is two of them, because one is absolutely looking fabulous in my garden right now, and the other is to assuage my guilt about not including a native lately. We'll be chatting with Christy Wilhelmi of Gardener Tip of the Week podcast, who's going to go over some of her favorite tips on a lot of different topics. And lastly, our playlist will include what to do in your garden right now, and maybe what to listen to. So what's new? I've had a couple of presentations that I've done lately. I went over to Williamsburg and talked to the Ford's Colony Garden Club. That's one of the biggest clubs in the Commonwealth of Virginia, which is fun. And then I did a Zoom that I had permission to share. The link is on my website under the speaking tab. And just scroll down a little bit. I put it pretty near the top. It's on YouTube. It is not perfect quality, but it's actually kind of an interesting talk because it was given to a group that volunteers and helps support the close, in other words, the grounds at the National Cathedral. That group is called the All Hallows Guild. And because Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. designed the land that the cathedral is on, I wanted to sort of celebrate him, although it's his father's 200th birthday that's coming up in, I think, in the spring. Anyway, I basically grabbed a few of the Olmsted tenants, be it junior or senior, and I made it so they might speak to the home gardener. So I thought it went pretty well for not being a Olmsted scholar at all, but talking about just how to get Olmsted in your garden. The nights are getting chilly, and I know that you are dying to know if I got all my plants in before my house guests came last weekend. No, not so much. But I did come up with a good rationale. When Marianne Wilburn was talking about getting them in to not shock them back to warm temperatures, I realized, well, wait, that really doesn't apply to me because I just slide them inside this glass door and they really don't live that much of a different life than they would outside. So that makes it so I've talked myself into not having to rush around so much. There's still a few out there. My sister-in-law, Mary, came to visit, and she is not a judgy gardener, but she is a master gardener. And just the word, like, that totally gets my attention, master gardener. I mean, I'm a certified horticulturist, and I do this for a living, but master, it just sounds so impressive. And I did remind you all last week that if you live in this area, you can look into being one. It's a national program. It's a wonderful program. And they volunteer their time to help others be good gardeners. Anyway, for the local Piedmont one, there's a link in the show notes if you would like to investigate how to become a master gardener. It is no small undertaking, but it's really worth it. So one of the plants that's looking gorgeous in my garden right now, and it's getting to be slim pickings, is the Japanese anemone. And the bad news is that our plant of the week is yet another native of Asia. But the good news is that there is a native species in that genus, so I'm also including that one to make us all feel better. The first one I'll talk about is the Japanese anemone. And of course, it's native to Asia. It sounds like it's native to Japan, but it's actually native to China. So strange. Some people call it the windflower. It is a 3 to 4 foot herbaceous perennial. Herbaceous means it goes down to nothing in winter. And it grows in zones 4 through 8. It has agreeable medium green foliage that only gets, a couple feet tall. The real action is the shoots that shoot way up higher. And actually, this one gets to about 5 feet in my garden. Cute little 1-inch or so buttercup type of thing with really white petals and an orange center. And pollinators love it. And when I say white, that's my favorite type, but there are plenty of cultivars. There's this one or that one, higher and lower, a little earlier, a little later, whiter or pinker, or even more pink. But the gold standard is the tall white one called Honorine Jaubert, which is an award-winning cultivar, pure white petals with Tennessee orange stamens that come out of the little light green balls holding them. It wants sun, but it will bloom in shade, and the foliage can even crisp up a little bit in too much sun, but it takes such little real estate up. It's just a very vertical plant. It doesn't go wide, so you could squeeze it between some other plants and shade the foliage, which is sort of what I do in my yard. It doesn't have any special needs, no extra water, no special soil, and it only needs staking if you haven't jammed it into a crowded party, which is really kind of what you want to do. I have it growing in front, right next to some volunteer cleomys and held up also by a little stone wall. It's not a bad cut flower. It's pretty, but it doesn't last the longest in the vase for sure. And once established, your clump will spread. Almost as easy as pie to pull out and share, but not quite as easy as pie. There are things that are a lot harder to share, though. Is it deer resistant? I don't think so. The Missouri database says yes, but I guess the deer are hungrier in my neighborhood. I saw many munchings of it in many clients' gardens over the years. So no, I do not think it is deer resistant. So now let's make ourselves feel better and talk about the native anemone. This is Anemone virginiana, also called thimbleweed, also an herbaceous perennial, shorter, it's only 1 to 2 feet. And instead of blooming now, it blooms in spring, like April or May. So it can take also, just like its sister from Asia, it can also take full sun or some shade. And I really want to get some in my garden to serve as sort of an understory woodland plant to sprinkle around with ferns and heucheras. It can take much heavier shade, I think, than the Japanese anemone, and drier soil too, and even drought. And it grows in zones 2 through 8. I mean, 2 is way up there. That's Canada, baby. Similar buttercup look with 5 white sepals, but in the center, the stamens start yellow instead of orange, and then they go green. And then they are, like, they're on this tall bit in the center. I'm sure there's a botanical name for this tall bit that I'm talking about. So the little stamens fall off, and the green bit is left, and it looks like a thimble. This one spreads too, so if you have some, I'll swap you for some Honorine Joubert. Just saying. This is Into the Garden with Leslie on News Radio WINA. And coming up, we're going to talk with Christy Wilhelmi about all kinds of things in the garden, some of her favorite tips. Welcome back to Into the Garden with Leslie on News Radio WINA. We're chatting with Christy Wilhelmi of Garden Nerd Tip of the Week podcast again, because we had so much fun chatting with her a few months ago. And so I just thought that it would be great to have Christy back on the show because she, in her podcast, which is entitled Garden Nerd Tip of the Week, she gets a tip from all the experts that she talks to. And I'm like, oh, wow. Okay. So she's actually not just a fount of information because she's really smart about gardening, but also, you know, as I'm interviewing people, I am getting a little bit smarter. You must get super smart because of these tips. Thank you so much for joining me, Christy.
Thanks for having me back. It's fun to be here again.
Oh, good. So she has access to all kinds of information, and that's, you know, just a lot of tips from a lot of podcasts. So let's get to some of them. And I'm going to start selfishly with a topic that I know that not all listeners are really into, but I'm sorry, I am. And it is composting.
Yes.
It makes me so happy. And I'm talking a little bit, don't run away. This will be brief. But when I talk to my listeners about it, I'm sort of going through step by step, because I realized, Christy, that there would be so many ways to do it poorly and get fruit flies in your kitchen and like turn off your housemate and make people hate you. What are some ways that you make it easy on yourself?
Well, I have to start with the fact that, you know, having the right kind of bin is important for whatever your needs are. And so some people really prefer tumblers because they don't want to physically turn a pile. I prefer a standing bin. And the bin I have, unfortunately, isn't made anymore. It's called the BioStack, and it was made by Smith and Hawken, rest in peace, back in the day. And it's basically 3 frames that stack on top of each other and a lid. And you take the lid off and you set one frame down next to the bin and you start scooping material from the bin into the frame. And then you move the second frame on top of it. And it's like you're moving the material from one spot to another, and it makes it really easy to do. And I can turn a pile. I get a good workout. And in less than half an hour, I turn a pile and then it starts cooking again because I've unearthed all the new surface area and everything. So, you know, to answer your question about like what makes it easy, I also like to make the pieces as uniform as possible because then it makes it easy to turn. And so, you know, aim for 2-inch pieces, chop things up with your shovel. I do have a shredder. I have an electric Patriot shredder and I use it and it makes everything uniform. And so it's easier to turn.
Back up to the kitchen. You're making dinner and you've got your bin in the kitchen. What do you have there? How big, how often do you empty it? How smelly does it get?
Good question. So I have a stainless steel compost bucket on the counter. And I use stainless steel because the plastic bins that have the filters or the bags in them, they all take on smells. And that's just not something I want. The stainless steel does not take on odors, and you can rinse it out really easily. So I got mine from Gardener's Supply. It's a really attractive stainless steel, kind of shiny bucket that sits there.
Ooh, we like shiny, shiny
brushed metal. It's brushed metal. I lied. And so, you know, I actually have two of them on the counter because we have one for the worm bin or the biogas, which is another subject altogether, and one for the compost bin because they want different things. So you can keep it under your sink, and, you know, when it fills up, it goes out into the compost pile. And the trick I have for making sure that there aren't a whole lot of fruit flies is always end in brown. Your top layer on your compost pile should always be carbon brown, dried dead material. And whether that's shredded paper or cardboard or newspaper or leaves or twigs or whatever, you always have that layer on top. And then when I go out there to dump my green waste in there, I peel back part from one corner of the brown layer. I dump in the green part, and then I cover it back up with brown. And I've got...
You're talking about the stainless steel, the shiny or not so shiny bin on your counter.
Yeah.
You know, you've cracked your eggs, you've made your salad, all the greens are there. And now you're going to cover it up with a bit of newspaper just on the countertop?
No, that bucket is holding the material that's going to go out into the compost bin out in the yard. I'm not composting inside my house.
And so it's all nitrogen, no carbon, and the carbon comes outside.
That is true to some degree. One of the things I actually do to help keep it from smelling in that bucket on the counter is to crumble up some paper and put that on the very bottom before I start adding any green waste, because you know how as veggies start to rot, they create a lot of moisture.
Yes.
Well, the brown paper layer on the bottom leaves some space between the leachate, which, you know, the juices that form, they all drop to the bottom through the paper, and the green waste is actually sitting above it. So it doesn't sit there rotting in its own juices.
Okay.
It stays on this series of like an inch or so of crumpled paper on the bottom.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes.
As I'm explaining it to my listeners, you know, it's very daunting. And how would you do this without really making yourself or your housemates uncomfortable? It's garbage. It's garbage that you are a garbage collector, but it's for such a good cause. And so more and more information on how possibly to do it well. Hey, have you heard about there's some machine that they're making that it makes electric and on your counter and actually attractive and shiny and new? And I read the reviews and I just don't think there are enough reviews yet, but I'm hopeful for the future. What do you think?
You know, I'm not a big fan of those indoor composting things because, well, so far, every single one of them that I've seen being used by people breaks really easily.
Okay.
Or it's a giant dehydrator, and it dehydrates the food. So the moisture is gone. So you don't get the smell and you don't attract the flies. And it's basically just drying out the food scraps so that you can then pour that into your soil somewhere. And that's fine, except that the main reason why I recommend composting in a bin in your backyard is that you are building microbial life in that compost pile. And when you desiccate and dehydrate food waste, it does none of that. It does not attract breed microbes, doesn't breed fungi and bacteria and all the good stuff that your soil actually wants. So that's why.
Okay, I gotcha. And then, so back to, and listeners who don't like compost, hang on just one more.
We're almost done.
We're going to stop soon. Yeah. When you get outside, so I don't mind the fruit flies outside. I'm like, isn't this all beginning to cook and aren't they helping me? Right. So I don't care about that, but I know you have a very small property. I'm lucky, or I have a little bit of a big spot so that my place, I put it into a tumbler outside. I do actually have a tumbler and I tumble it, and then I stuff in some newspapers, and then I put it in my real compost pile, which has every weed, you know, grass stick, blah, 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 blah. And it all cooks down. So, unless you really have a sense of clean, buggies outside, that's okay, right? They don't hurt anything.
Yeah, I think people often have the only place they can have them is like right under the kitchen window or something like that outside. So then that's where fruit flies become a little bit of an issue. And So that's where I come back to always end in brown, because that helps keep that down. It also helps keep the smells down, so the vermin and the, you know, raccoons, the trash pandas don't come looking for them.
Yeah.
That happens too. And, you know, you can put a brick on the lid, help keep it locked down tight. And it usually is something that it's okay if there are bugs in your compost bin, because that's where they belong.
Okay. All right. Great answers. And one more. I have, my listeners might know that I've recently changed my business model so that my beloved crew is now working for my wonderful Abby. And I am all of a sudden like, whoa, wait, there's not stacks of potting soil in my driveway like there used to be. I don't want to go buy those things. I'm too lazy. And I have all these compost piles. So I want to make my own potting soil, but I realized because my compost piles are not very hot, and that's okay with me. I just spread it around and I edit the seedlings that come from it. But that really won't do if I want potting soil, because I do like to have pretty containers. Is there a step that I can take to make potting soil out of my compost?
Yeah. You know, if you look at most bags of potting soil or whatever planting mix, any of those things, there's going to be, you know, compost is an ingredient, organic matter is an ingredient, and, you know, it's mostly broken down. And the thing about bag potting soil is that they've sterilized it and then they've added mycorrhizae back in, and endo and ecto mycorrhizae. But if you're pulling it out of your compost bin, you don't have to add endo and ecto mycorrhizae back in, because it's hopefully already in there, as well as other bacteria and wonderful other good things. So, you know, for me, I usually follow a couple of different schools of thought. With John Jevons, How to Grow More Vegetables Than You Ever Thought Possible on Less Land Than You Can Imagine, he has a recipe that's basically a third, a third, a third existing soil, a third compost, and a third old seed flat mix. But that's to make your own seed starting mix. But that, I digress. Basically, you can use your compost as the organic matter ingredient. And then I like to mix it with coconut coir instead of peat moss. And then you can add either perlite or vermiculite, depending on whether you need good drainage or moisture retention. So,
oh, and that depends on the plants.
Exactly. Yeah, and okay. Your climate. Are you in the desert where it's a buck 10 every day and you need to keep moisture in that pot? Then you're using vermiculite. If you have kind of clay-ish other elements that are going on in that pot, or you need something that drains really well and doesn't like wet feet, then you're putting in perlite.
Okay.
And then mix in you can always throw in extra things like coffee grounds or your fertilizer that you want for that particular type of plant. And that works.
Okay. I'm gonna try it and let you know next spring. This is Into the Garden with Leslie on News Radio WINA. This show is brought to you by Dos Amigos Landscaping and Holistic Pest Solutions. And we're talking with Christy Wilhelmy about her favorite garden tips, and we are off compost. No more. Just as a reminder, Christy has written three books that you can order from her website, which is pretty easy, gardennerd.com. Her podcast is gardennerdtipoftheweek.com. Cleverly, Garden Nerd is spelled like gardener with a D at the end, which is awesome. Her three books are Grow Your Own Mini Fruit Garden, Gardening for Geeks, which she says she is, but I don't believe it. And although maybe I do a little bit when she goes into science that I don't understand, and we're on Zoom, she sees my eyes glaze over, she comes back to me. 400 Tips for Organic Gardening Success is another book of hers. 400 tips. All right. So you're the right person to interview. Let's talk about fruit trees in small spaces, because even though I live in a place where lots of people have lots of space, you might be that gardener who's, you know, downsized or, you know, just doesn't really want a whole lot more on their property. What are some tips on that?
Well, the book itself focuses on all the different techniques and strategies out there to grow fruit trees in small spaces, starting with backyard orchard culture, which is all about keeping trees at what I call, or it is called, home orchard height, where you're not growing it. First of all, you're choosing a dwarf or semi-dwarf or miniature tree. You're not letting it get over. My preference is 8 to 10 feet tall. Some people like to get it as big as 15 because they're not afraid to get up on a ladder. I don't want to have to pull out a ladder to harvest. And so you're using pruning techniques, mostly summer pruning, to keep things smaller. And then also there are tricks like combination planting, where you're planting three or four trees in the same planting hole and they're all growing together because they're all in the same family, like all citrus or all stone fruits or, you know, the palm fruits all together. And then you can play around with things like multi-fruit trees and or espalier trees to use up less space. And that's like the beginning of the book talks about those concepts as a fun way to play with space.
Tell me about the planting all in one hole. So I think of a tree as being a multidimensional thing. And then what if are you talking how many in the same hole? Can you do two, three?
When I say the same hole, I exaggerate a little. Basically, if you're digging a hole for your tree, you would make that hole about 3 to 5 feet bigger than you would for one tree.
Okay.
And so you're conditioning the soil in that space, and you can plant trees 18 to 24 inches apart in the same grouping. And the idea is that if you're planting them in a square or a circle, you're pruning the center of that combination so that there isn't a lot of crossing branches. There's some good airflow, but everything's growing as kind of a circular hedge along the outer part of that combination,
including the fruit.
And you can decide to pick say, let's take stone fruits. You can pick a early season peach, a mid season plum, a late season nectarine, and an apricot, because you get that for when you get that, you know, it's like a 2 week harvest period. And so you'll have not only 4 fruits in the space of like 1.5 trees, you'll have succession of harvest where you're not just getting 400 fruits from one tree for a 2 week period or a 3 week period. You're harvesting for several months of different fruits the whole time. I always think of Barbara Kingsolver's book, Animal Vegetable Miracle. She talks about the vegetannual, which is like one series of harvest that comes one after the other from the garden.
That is a very cool concept. And I'm wondering, so maybe the plum tree is my favorite, say.
Yeah.
If I grew the plum tree all by itself, would production be better because it's not sharing a hole?
Yes. You would get fewer fruits from these trees, but the concept, you know, I often ask people, what do you do with 400 plums? I want to know.
And please tell me.
Right. Please tell me, because I've had to process that and all at once, and it's a real challenge.
Yeah.
So we have this expectation of our fruit trees and what we, but it really outsizes most of our needs. And yeah, you know, we can share fruits with other people and freeze them for later and bake them into pies and all of that. But you're still getting a reasonable amount of fruit from trees in a smaller space and pruning them to a smaller size. So it's kind of like you get to weigh the options there.
Okay. That's a great answer. And I feel like that just makes such good sense. I mean, I'm not a fruit tree grower, but it would be kind of no fun to be overwhelmed. And I know that, you know, seeing trees grow together in any kind of tree grow together in a community, those roots get married under the ground and they make each other really happy, right?
Yeah. They're all working together I always think of it like the penguins in the South Pole, where they're huddling together for warmth. They're creating a little ecosystem for themselves in that space. And if you're pruning out the center so that there's enough airflow, they grow as one unit, you know, they grow together
as
one
unit. Yeah. That is very cool. All right. This is Into the Garden with Leslie on News Radio WINA, brought to you by Dos Amigos Landscaping and Holistic Pest Solutions. We're talking with Christy Wilhelmi about the many garden tips she has collected over the years. And I know, or maybe we're just picking her brain. I mean, I have no idea whether these tips are coming from her or everybody. I do listen to your podcast, and I know that sometimes people offer more philosophical tips than practical ones. I kind of like the practical ones better myself, because I feel like anybody who's listening to your podcast, and you and I, you know, we don't need any like, and get into the garden. Although, you know, that is the gist of my podcast, get into the garden. Let's get into the garden. But I feel like, well, wait, what do I do once I get there? Don't tell me what to think. Tell me what to do. So I'm going to just mention a few of your guests that you've had. And if you could just give me a little bit of information on each topic, whether it's from that guest or from your own brain. You've had Charlie Nardozzi on, and he's great about no-dig gardening. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Charlie has this new book I guess it's not so new anymore, but when I had him on, it was new. And the no-dig gardening, he was basically culling together all kinds of different techniques, like straw bale gardening, or which doesn't really work great where I live because it's so dry and it takes a lot of water to get a straw bale wet. But once it's wet, it stays wet and that's good. Straw bale, no till, you know, no dig gardening based on Ruth Stout's philosophy. I'm not sure if your listeners are familiar with her, but there's this charming little 20-minute documentary on her on the internet. If you look up Ruth Stout on YouTube, basically she developed this whole concept of just throwing biomass down on the ground after you're done growing it and then planting stuff inside it and stuff grows. And, you know,
stuff is thrown.
And then, yeah. And so she, you know, there's this part in this documentary, it's really cute about how she just, she's like, I'm going to plant potatoes. And she just takes potatoes and throws them into this pile of biomass. And she's like, I just planted potatoes. And it's
Is she kind of a little old lady who lives somewhere in one of those southern states? I mean, I live in a southern state, but deep south, right?
I think so. I can't remember exactly.
I have a vague memory of being totally charmed by this.
Yes. And so it really is, especially for aging gardeners, kind of a concept to embrace, honestly. And you know, of course, he does talk about the benefits of no-till is, of course, that you're leaving your soil microbial network in place. And that, for those who don't know, is called the soil food web. And it's fungi and bacteria and protozoa and nematodes. They've all made these special connections, particularly fungal hyphae, where they're reaching deep down from roots that are in the soil down to minerals. They're grabbing on rocks and siphoning nutrients to the plant roots from, it could be even, you know, a feet, miles away. I mean, like really, it's an incredible network. And every time you pull out the rototiller, you destroy that. You basically hit frappe and they have to start all over again. So no dig gardening and no till gardening, which, you know, I think of Ruth Stout when I think of no dig gardening, and I think of the soil food web when I think of no till. But it's all about less labor in a sense, you know, where you're just working on top. You add compost to the top, you would put mulch over everything, and you plant your stuff and it grows because the soil biology is all intact below.
I mentioned this to my sister who I had on the show a couple of weeks ago, and she goes, wait a minute. You mean that double digging thing? Was that the work of some gardening sadist?
So that's funny because John Jevons is a big proponent of double digging. I've spoken to him a couple of times and I said, so John, are you still with all the no-till research out there? Are you still a proponent of double digging? He said, if you take rock solid clay soil, do you want to try a no-dig on that? And I'm like, you're right. No. He says, so, you know, do the double digging to get it going. And then once you've incorporated compost and therefore microbes into the soil, it's going to improve after that. And then you can switch to no-till. So I would say it still has value.
I think it still has value too. Where I live, you know, in the land of very deep red clay, when you go digging in this around here, you're like, oh my God, what is that color? Who painted that? And so if you were to start on that kind of land and make a garden, I do think that you might have to get that shovel out. At the same time, you can think about it in terms of if you were to plant a bunch of trees, it's not like you have to dig all of it. Those roots on things that want to be old and age in place will find their way. You have to make sure those little baby roots right now are comfortable, but the ones that are coming that go for miles, they're going to make their way through that soil structure, won't they?
Yeah, they will. And it's the important thing is, I can't stress the importance of mulch enough because mulch is a fungal food and that feeds fungal hyphae and they go up, grab that mulch, start breaking it down. Your soil becomes more aerated and permeable and then they start drilling down into deeper soils to mine the nutrients. And it just makes a huge difference.
Three
to 5 inches of mulch.
Of mulch and any kind of mulch. I've been talking to my listeners a lot lately about leaving the leaves as mulch. Now, I imagine you don't have quite as many deciduous trees out where you are in California. And so how do you treat leaves? Do you employ them in your garden?
We do leave them where they fall most of the time. There is a street out here that has some leaves that, you know, the whole street drops its leaves and I will go collect those.
You want them for yourself.
You can do that. I mean, if you've got an oak tree anywhere near where you live, that makes the best mulch and compost material. I'll just say that. So yeah, you can go knock on people's doors and say, are you going to use those leaves? And just clean them up for them. They don't know what they're missing. If they're used to leaving them bagged on the curb, they don't know what they're missing. So
I had a question yesterday. I did a presentation about encouraging people to do this and, you know, don't leave it on your lawn. Don't leave it on your patio. Don't, you know, you want to see your front walk. That's all fine. But to get it to the gardens, and she said, you know, would that not make the soil too acidic? And I pointed out that most plants like a decent, you know, are slightly more inclined to like slightly more acid soil. You know, you are the scientist. I am not. That was the right answer.
I wish I was a scientist. I listen to scientists, but, you know, there is a difference between acidic and allelopathic. Allelopathy is something where certain types of leaves like pine needles, they have a compound in them that prevents things from growing. I was just listening to, there was an online conference called Back to Eden, and one of the speakers was Dr. Linda Chalker-Scott, and she did a whole talk on arborist wood chips being the best mulch for gardens and landscapes, and I couldn't agree more. Arborist wood chips are, you know, basically you get connected to an arborist in your neighborhood, or you can sign up for this thing called Chip Drop, which I think is nationwide.
Nice, Chip
and
Drop.
Yeah, chipdrop.in as an industry. And they basically, it connects, it's an app that connects you, the gardener, the homeowner, with arborists who are out there pruning trees and they need a place to put them, the biomass when they're done. And so it's the best kind of mulch. But she also happened to mention something about how there really aren't any studies that prove that allelopathic compounds actually do stop things from growing. So I was like, really? She hasn't run across a study that faithfully proves that. So interesting.
Yeah.
Little bit of knowledge there. You know, nature always wins, and putting leaves where they fall is a great idea, and or moving them to where you want them, which is your
exactly. You don't want to cover up the cute little 2-inch you know, cyclamen that you're trying to make enjoy right now. You know, get them off of that.
Yes, exactly. So you can tidy up, but certainly if you can leave them, the tree will use that back. That will decompose and become food for the tree again. So it's cyclic. It's cyclical.
That's so great. And it makes it so we don't have to, you know, work so hard in the garden. Yeah. One more little topic, and that is literally little. You had Mike Lizotte on to talk about mini meadows. And I've been encouraging in my presentations that I've done lately, just, you know, I have this great slide of this huge, beautifully mown lawn. It's almost like artwork. And I'm like, sure, it's beautiful, but come on, man, it looks like they're about to host a jamboree for like 4 lacrosse teams. how about we have a little bit less lawn? And then if you just want to experiment with a little bit of a meadow, because they're not easy. What did Mike have to say, or do you have any tips on that?
Yeah, Mike Lizotte, he's the owner of American Meadows and of High Country Gardens. And they're, depending on where you live, they have seed collections for mini meadows, either for drought tolerant locations or for, you know, places that get lots of rain. And his whole thing is about, you can have like a 3 square foot area of space and plant these seeds. And it is habitat and pollen and nectar for pollinators. It's, you know, beautiful. And if you buy, you know, perennial varieties that come back year after year, those are going to be your foundational plants that show up in this meadow. Plus then you can toss in some other seeds that reseed themselves, like poppies or marigolds, calendula, you know, alyssum, love and a mist. These are all things that they're flowers that reseed themselves every year. I planted nasturtiums 20 years ago and they come back every year. I've never had to plant nasturtiums again. You know, and that's the kind of thing that, yeah, they get a little ugly during certain parts of the dry season, but then they start, and as soon as rains come again or you irrigate them, they pop back up. And it's a lovely way of setting up a swath of flowers for the insects and pollinators and birds and everything that lives in your garden, you know, because they like to hang out there.
So a nice snackable meadow, like literally you could just say, okay, this little, I'm going to put a little, I don't know, a little bird bath in the middle of a tiny little meadow. And that's right. it. You know, yeah. I'm not scaring myself. We're not like changing the lawn. I think it would be really fun. There's so many things I want to try in gardening.
Yeah. He has a video on how to create a mini meadow. And basically you just carve out the space. You can use a garden hose to map out the outline and then carve out that part of your lawn, clear it. And then you lay down your seeds. You usually work in a little bit of compost just to make sure the soil is working. And then you cover it with some soil and water it. And there you go. That's your mini meadow.
Magic, magic. Thank you so much for helping us out with all these tips. I really enjoyed talking to you again.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Okay. Well, you can find Christy on gardennerd.com and her podcast is Gardener Tip of the Week. And she is just so, it's so fun to talk to her because she has so many good things to say about all aspects of gardening. This is Into the Garden with Leslie on News Radio WINA. And we'll be right back with the playlist, weekly practical information on what to do in your garden right now, and maybe what to listen to at the same time. Welcome back to Into the Garden with Leslie. How good is that Christy Wilhelmi? She is so fun to listen to, so knowledgeable. And then, of course, I'm always learning from her and she's always learning from others. It's a learning thing. I'm going to put links to her podcast and her blog in the show notes, so have a look. And also a link to Ruth Stout. So as soon as she mentioned this YouTube that she talked about with the no-dig gardening, I was like, oh, I've seen that. And I don't know about you. My memory is terrible. I watch things. I'm like, I have to get 45 minutes into it before I know who the murderer is. I've seen this before. Ruth Stout, I immediately remembered this YouTube. It was so cool. She was born in 1884. She ended up living in the country and she had to learn how to garden so that she could feed her family. She wanted to grow vegetables. She asked how to do it. So she was told. And after 15 years of doing it the way everybody else had taught her to do it, the commercial fertilizations, the poisonous spray, the plowing, one year the plowman just didn't show up. So she was frustrated. She needed to grow this food. And she just sort of looked at her garden and she said, why can't everybody be like asparagus and just come back? So she started this thing where she never tilled again. And she gardened and gardened and gardened for the rest of her life, happily ever after, without digging anything. And it's an enchanting YouTube. I'm going to put the link in the show notes. Questions from listeners. Brad, my Instagram friend, who is garden.evolution, and he gardens in Ohio, he had a great question that I wanted to share. He had bought some shrubs that he doesn't want to plant until next spring. But he was like, but is it okay to just leave them in their plastic pots all winter? And the answer to that is no. I mean, you could, but you're taking a bit of a chance even here in Virginia, and I think more in Ohio. So those same plants would survive if they were planted in the ground. The reason that it's riskier to leave them out is not because it's colder. Well, it might be. I guess a few feet of ground, you know, a foot of ground provides some insulation. But mainly it's the stress that is put on a plant when they freeze and then they thaw, freeze, thaw, freeze, thaw. And so you want to avoid that. You want to just settle them in and keep them frozen for the winter. And so I suggested to him that he either heel them in, which is just sort of digging them in their pots. If he wants, just find an empty space in his garden and put them, even if you planted them like 3/4 of the way, they'd be better off. And or mulch them heavily. So you could put them next to, you know, a shed wall and then just pile up some hay or straw or leaves around them. And that way, once they get to a temperature, they're going to basically stay there and not feel so stressed. Mary Wright, who actually I mentioned on the podcast last week, she was listening to the presentation that I did about Frederick Law Olmsted. And in that presentation, I mentioned 5 alien invasives that I really dislike. There are lots of them to dislike. Now, mind you, you know me, I'm not really upset about aliens as long as they're not doing any harm. But the aliens invasives are the ones that basically take over the woods and they make it so natives can't grow easily. In our food chain, lots of animals don't recognize them as anything else but physical habitat. So in other words, they're not feeding anything. They're not recognized as food. So just to go down the list, the worst offender in my book is the ailanthus or the tree of heaven, the Hedera helix, which is English ivy. Oh man, that stuff. And I know that you can actually buy that in a nursery and it can make a very effective and charming looking ground cover. And I love it spilling out of a pot. But if it's growing wild in your yard and growing vertical, it is setting seed and it is seeding all over any woods that might be near you. The oriental bittersweet. That's the Celastris orbiculatus. Hey, did you know, because I didn't, that there's a native bittersweet
That's the Psilastra scandens. Now, the great thing about the one that's so terrible is that it has these berries all on one vine that are like orange and red and yellow, and it could look perfect and beautiful in a fall arrangement. The Psilastra scandens, the native one, only has red berries. But couldn't we get along with that if they're good for the woods instead of bad? The Berberis thunbergii or the Barberry, oh man, you know, that strange red color is cropping up in forests. And the ligustrum or privet. And there are lots of different kinds of that. Poor Mary was listening to this list, and she had just planted an entire row of them at her house, of the ligustrum. And I felt so bad because she chose a really good plant for what she needed. She needed privacy. She needed a beautiful waxy evergreen leaf and those early sweet summer flowers that attract a ton of pollinators, really. But like it's semi-deciduous around here, I think it's fully deciduous further north, cousin, the privet, the seeds do invade the woods. Now, Mary lives in suburbia, and if she enjoys it and then she deadheads it, she won't be hurting anything at all. So you know why alien invasives are bad. I don't think Mary's hurting anything, and it was cute of her to feel, what did she say? She was a little nauseous. You can control what's in your garden, even if it has the potential to be bad. If you're controlling it, you're okay. And my friend Dana had a dahlia question that, of course, I turned right over to the expert, Beverly Lacey of Blue Heron Farm, who I interviewed a few weeks ago. So the question was floppy stems. Dana has these beautiful dahlias, and she sent me this beautiful photograph of like a 10-inch stem. The dahlia is at the end of it, and it's just kind of broken in the middle, so not near any of the leaves or anything, and not apparently obvious what is going on. So what Bev said was that it's pretty normal at this time of year. This plant, the dahlia, just blooms and blooms and blooms, and it begins to kind of peter out right at this time of year. And so think about what a plant wants to do. It wants to reproduce itself. And the way it does that is with flowers. So it will continue to make the flowers with great strength, but it won't put as much energy. Maybe it can't put as much energy into the structure of the plant. So that's perhaps why it's flopping. So nothing wrong. You're just not going to have those beautiful, long, firm stems that you might have had before. And you can have the shorter stems. And remember, you could float them in a bowl. And the next step to the compost. So I've been going over compost not to tell you what you should do, but to tell you what I do. I find it so easy that I'm just hoping to inspire some of you to give it a try. And the two reasons to do it are, one, you can improve your soil greatly. Actually, three reasons when you think about it. I mean, what do you do if you clean up in your garden, you pull some weeds and all that stuff? Where does that stuff go? I mean, I wouldn't only be able to put it in a compost pile. I wouldn't put it in the garbage. In terms of the kitchen compost, if you send that off to a landfill, that is such high nitrogen that it's actually producing methane, which is a greenhouse gas, which leads to global warming and climate change. So we could avoid that. I know that sounds silly. It's like, come on, I'm just a family of four with my garbage and everybody's doing it. But if you're one person less who's not doing it, that would be cool. And then you would have the added benefit of awesome soil. So let me go back to my first couple steps. I got you through the kitchen. We didn't have any fruit flies. We didn't have much odor. We got these little sealable containers out to the garage, and they're just sitting there on the shelf, and nobody's going to get into them. And once I get about 8 or 10 of them out there, it's time to put them into my tumbler that my friend Sondi Venn gave to me. So I grab a bunch of She's not into kitchen garbage. And we all don't have to be into kitchen garbage. It's okay. So I grab the bins, the little sealable bins, and I grab some copies of the Wall Street Journal, and I dump it all in there, and I tumble a few times. You might ask, how often do you do this? And was there stuff in the tumbler before? And are you insane? Let me just address all of those questions. Last one first. No, pretty sure not insane. Just don't really mind bad smells, I guess, and I really like good soil. In terms of how often I do this, it probably takes about 2 weeks for me to get enough to say, oh, I need a fresh supply of clean ones in my kitchen, so I dump them and wash another batch. In terms of, was there already compost cooking in that tumbler? Absolutely yes. I don't empty that tumbler very often at all because it is cooking down nicely. It's in full sun, and especially in the summer, it heats right up and cooks right down. So I'm not emptying that, which is a yucky job. Probably every 4 or 5 months, more often in the winter because it just doesn't decompose as easily in the winter because the heat isn't there. So the goal of this step, to put it in the tumbler, is to have it become something that won't be recognized as food. Not by me, not by various scavengers who might be interested. And that's important because in the next step, which I'll describe next week, it's going outside, not in the garage, not in a tumbler, outside, and we don't want food outside. What are we doing in the garden this week? If you live in colder climes, you should feel good about taking away anything that is bumming you out, such as browns and downs and leaves that are making you sad. But whatever you leave, remember, becomes habitat for buggies and beasties and things that we want in our yard. So take it away if it's making you sad. It's your garden. Put it on the compost pile. Leave it there if it's not. You may be planting bulbs. We here are not even close. You can do it here, gosh, up until Christmas. So my sort of take on that is to think, well, the less time that the rodents who might eat the bulbs have time to find them, the better. So I actually wait until quite late. Remember that there's no big pruning now. Your projects can wait until things are dormant. Please mow your leaves into the lawn or have your guys do it. Ask your lawn gentlemen or lawn ladies to do that for you. Remember that you might be able to control the volume and intensity of leaf cleanup at your home. Talk to whomever is doing that, even if it's yourself, and see if you can't dial it back or dial it down a little bit, a few untidy bits, and maybe not so loud. If you have a water feature, you may have to net it at this time of year because of the leaves falling and gumming it up. I do have a water feature, but I'm going to try something new myself. I will net as usual, but I'm going to leave some parts open for birds and other animals to be able to get to it. I'm going to set up some sieves. I'm going to use poultry fencing that has pretty large holes for the water to pass through at a couple of places that would be easy for me to grab and dump out the accumulated leaves every couple of days in theory. I just have to remember to do that part of it. The reason that I want to leave it open for the first time since I've had my water feature is inspired by a podcast that I listened to about wildlife in the garden, and the person said, don't cover up your water feature. Well, I'm still going to cover up my water feature, but I'm going to leave some of it for the beasties to get at. And what to listen to? I am going to direct you back to composting. We can never get enough. To Margaret Roach's interview with Carrie Ocean. So I've mentioned Margaret before. She's my gardening mentor. I wish I knew her. If anybody knows her, let's connect me, okay? She does that podcast and has that website called A Way to Garden, and she does fabulous interviews. And this last one was with a guy named Carrie Oceans of the U.S. Composting Council. And yes, there is such a thing. I love this interview because it was so freeing. Carrie Oceans knows everything there is to know about the science of composting, the rules, the temperatures, all the things that you must do. But does he do any of that as a personal composter? No. No science. And it's great because it's like he's saying, let's not have reasons not to do this. What if I don't want to check the temperature? What if I don't want to turn it? You don't have to turn it. You don't have to check the temperature. You just have to have a place in your yard where you're putting stuff that will degrade biologically. And then in a year or in 2 years, if it's really shady and cold, or in 6 months, you can go back and find some beautiful soil under there to add to your garden. So great interview. I'll put a link in the show notes. This was fun. If you have any questions or comments or corrections, please reach out to me. I am Leslie Harris, LH at Instagram, or my website is lhgardens.com. And this is the time when I ask you to do something for me because I've given you this podcast, and I'm going to stick with just please tell your friends about the podcast. I was almost ready to tell you how you might contribute to the podcast. There was a cute lady at one of my presentations last week who said, oh, a podcast. So how do you make money doing a podcast? And the answer to that is you don't make money doing a podcast, but I am going to be setting up a place where I can receive contributions. I'm going to try to make it cute and clever, like, you know, buy a bone for Ginny or buy me a Coors Light or something, because I do this out of the goodness of my heart. I'm hopeful that you all will be able to contribute in future, but it's not there now. If you could just tell somebody about it, and thank you for doing that. I do appreciate it. I named this show Into the Garden with Leslie because I'm into mine. I want to get you into yours. I will see you next week.